Inviting me to be here. I'm very glad to be here. And I'm going to talk about passage of time and emergent levels, top-down and bottom-up cascades. And I'm going to have a summary, the direction of time, eras of time, the thermodynamic, the electrodynamic, evolutionary, psychological eras of time, and some closing notes. So the thesis is that both bottom-up and top-down causation links the eras of time to the direction of time at different scales. So we've got to distinguish the direction of time and eras of time, which will be the first thing I will do. The direction of time is determined in a bottom-up way through the nature of space-time in an evolving block universe. We already heard a bit about that earlier, an idea put forward by C.D. Broad in 1923. Then the basic era of time, the thermodynamic second law, is determined in a top-down way through a global initial condition, and we've already heard about the global initial condition from several speakers. The electromagnetic era of time is determined through the space-time structure and a global initial condition, as I will go and talk about. And these two eras then determine the other local eras in a bottom-up way through processes of emergence. We just were hearing about processes of emergence. And my theme, tying in with what Lee said at the beginning, is that time exists in the real universe. And I'm not going to talk about Minkowski space-time. I want to talk about the real universe, time in cosmology. Okay? So the context in which this occurs is the hierarchy of structure and causation, and there are actually two hierarchies. The natural sciences one on the left, fundamental theory, particle physics, atomic physics, physical chemistry, material science, geology, earth science, space science, astronomy, cosmology, those are just names. The life sciences, fundamental theory, particle physics, atomic physics, the bottom three levels are the same. Then chemistry, biochemistry, cell biology, physiology, psychology, sociology, economics, politics. The top levels are very, very different. And it's really important, if you want to talk about bottom-up and top-down causation, you need to characterize how are you describing the levels. And I'm going to think of these levels and how the interaction takes place between these levels. If you don't clearly separate out what levels you're talking about, then you're going to get in a muddle about all of this. So the direction of time. I'm going to talk about an evolving block universe. And this is a block universe with dynamics governed by general relativity, field equations, absolutely standard, but with a future boundary that is the ever-changing present. The future boundary changes as time passes, as Broad said, and as Professor Muller said a little bit earlier today. The age of the universe is proper time measured along Ricci eigenlines since the start of the universe. And Ricci eigenlines will always be unique in the real universe. You measure proper time along Ricci eigenlines, and that gives you the age of the universe at each instant. And this continually increases with the passing of time. So, for example, the Planck satellite in March 2013 determined the age of the universe to be 13.82 times 10 to the 9 years. And they didn't say this is the age of galaxies in the universe. They said this is the age of the universe. Okay? And now the time is T0 plus 4 years because we've had another 4 years and the block universe has evolved by 4 years since that measurement was made. The block universe is a little bigger than it was at that time. So there's a picture of the evolving block universe. It's going, there's a bottom boundary, which is the beginning of the universe, a top boundary, which is the present time, and its future boundary is the present. The time now is that yellow surface, and it continually increases with the passage of time, and it keeps going. And the direction of time is that arrow which points from the start of the universe to the part of the universe which is moving upwards with time. Now that is unique. It points from the start of the universe to the present. And it's globally determined. It's determined on a large scale. You can't tell what that arrow is by looking at some little region in the universe. It's a non-locally determined quantity. The direction of time is determined through initial conditions for the evolution of space-times, which then gives you how the Einstein field equations work. The bottom-up effect of local gravity everywhere in an expanding universe determines its evolution as time passes. And this is nothing other than standard cosmology. The evolution equation is the Friedmann equation, which is time symmetric. So the evolution equation, completely time symmetric. It gives a standard outcome, and I'm just going to, for simplicity, take the radiation-dominated early universe with no curvature, no cosmological constant, and the pressure is a third the density. The time t since the start of the time t is the proper time since the start of the universe. And you solve that equation, and you get at is a naught t to the half for t greater than naught. This is an expanding universe, not a contracting universe. The universe is getting larger with time. I know there's a whole debate about whether does the universe actually expand. Just to make that non-controversial, I'm actually thinking of a space with closed sections. At early times, you can ignore the K term, but nevertheless, a space with closed sections is getting bigger as the universe expands because the space sections are expanding. Now, the time symmetry implies there's also a contracting solution in which you've got exactly the same solution, but for the modulus of t to the half for t less than naught. Now, if you simply set t prime goes to, there should be a minus sign there, then you get back this equation as in the observed universe. The initial condition for what is observed is that at the initial time, the universe was expanding. So there are two solutions because the equations are time symmetric. You choose the one in which the universe is expanding because that's what we actually happen to see. Now, the arrows of time. We can order the frames we've just looked at by increasing value of the age of universe. So if you took those pictures I had and they were randomly shuffled, you would be able to order them by placing them so that each, the bigger ones, were at later times than the earlier ones. The direction of time will point from the fixed edge to the edge which is moving up. And the question is, why do the local arrows of time agree with the non-local direction of time? So there is the direction of time. It starts at the beginning of the universe and points to the present day. And that's the electrodynamic arrow of time, the thermodynamic arrow of time, and the psychological arrow of time. And the question is, why does the thermodynamic time agree, as David Albert was talking about? Why does the electrodynamic arrow of time agree, as Einstein talked about, in the psychological era of time, which you can, if you want to, separate into a memory one and an action one. So we've got the non-local one. These are local. These happen in this room. These arrows are occurring in this room. That one is not happening in this room. It's a completely non-local one. And you have to know the history of the universe to know what is the direction of time. Okay, the thermodynamic era of time. It aligns with the direction of time because of special initial conditions at the start of the universe. And we've had a whole discussion about this. There's a past hypothesis. Roger Penrose has talked about this at length, David Albert, Sean Carroll. And basically, the essential point is entropy can't grow if it's already a maximum. So you need the cosmological hypothesis that in the very distant past, entropy was lower so that entropy can grow. Otherwise, it can't grow. Hence, the universe must start off in a smooth state in order that standard thermodynamics will apply in the forward direction of time, and inflation will work as usually supposed. And Roger Penrose has emphasized this very much. Ordinary inflation assumes thermodynamics, and that thermodynamic assumption isn't fulfilled unless you have very special conditions at the start of the universe. Now, appealing to this boundary at the start of the universe gives the second law in the future direction of time, because as we've discussed already, from the micro level, just using a bottom-up derivation of the second law, you can get the second law to go both directions of time. That's Loschmidt's paradox. That applies equally to the quantum derivation of the arrow of time given by Steven Weinberg in his book on quantum field theory. So when you coarse grain, because of overwhelming probability, given that boundary condition, then the second law will increase in the direction of time which agrees with the arrow of time. And just talking about this, Eddington wrote absolutely beautifully about the second law in his book, The Nature of the Physical Universe, many years ago. And Roger Penrose has a very nice discussion in his book on conformal cyclic cosmologies. Now, the claim I make is that this is now a top-down effect from variables described at large scales to local physics. If it wasn't true everywhere, if the special condition didn't hold everywhere, the second law would not apply in the same way everywhere in the universe. And the way this works, for instance, the basic arrow of time, the second law, spreads to local physics in a top-down way from these global initial conditions. And an example is nucleosynthesis in the early universe. By that expansion law one, the temperature goes down as t to the half as the universe expands. That means the average motion of molecules goes as 1 over their mass times kbt, and so the average speed of the molecules is proportional to the scale of the universe, and so the scale of the universe is affecting the local velocity of molecules in the universe, and that's because of the Einstein equations and the equations of state of matter, and then the relation from there to there is through local statistical mechanics, which applies because of the phase space possibilities apply to standard statistical mechanics. So as time passes, the universe gets larger and therefore gets cooler. And this determines nuclear reaction rates. That equation determines nuclear reaction rates. And so the helium fraction of about 0.25, you wouldn't be able to explain that helium fraction if time ran the other way. It depends on the decay of neutrons to protons after neutrinos freeze out and equilibrium ends. So the key equation is the decay of the neutrons to protons, electrons, and neutrinos. And one of the interesting questions is, why does that go in one direction and not the other? And that's basically because the mass of the neutron is bigger than the mass of the proton, and so this is energetically favorable reaction. It's a top-down effect from macro variables. So, yeah?
What do you mean if time went the other way?
Sorry?
What do you mean time went the other way?
Martin Rees wrote a beautiful paper many years ago called Cosmic Eschatology, in which he took a universe KS plus one and looked at the thermal history of the universe as it expands and then collapses down. And the thermal history is completely different during the expanding phase and the collapsing phase because of all the astrophysical processes, particularly the irreversible processes. From time to time in the history of the universe, there are irreversible processes. And so the history of the universe is not a reversible process. Now, this is a top-down effect from macro variables defined only at cosmological scale to statistical effects of weak forces and nuclear processes. So what I'm asking you to do is to ask you, in that initial condition, on what scale must that initial condition be applied in order to work? And I claim that that initial condition must be applied at levels 10 and 9 in order to give you effects at level 4 and 5. So it's top down from that level down to that level. Now, maybe some of you will disagree, but that's the way that I view it. And that's why I say it's a top down effect from the cosmological scale, well, to the large scale structure scale, perhaps, down to the scale of atomic physics and particle physics. And this is what I'm saying, in order to keep track of what's going on here, you must keep this hierarchy in mind, and looking at any causal effect, ask yourself, which are the levels involved and how is it working? The electrodynamics era of time. We learn fine, yeah?
You have about 3 more minutes.
3 more minutes. The electrodynamics era of time, Wheeler and Feynman had their advanced and retarded solutions, and they had different conditions in the past. In the evolving block universe, the future doesn't yet exist, so we can't integrate the Green's function over the future because it doesn't exist. The electromagnetic field is therefore only the retarded one. You'll have terms due to electric charges and the initial field. If the latter is small, a past condition, no source-free radiation coming in, the field is determined by charges through the retarded Green functions, as is usual in local physics. Evolutionary and psychology. The emergence of life occurs through Darwinian selection. This involves top-down effects because selection is an adaptive process. The outcome is different if the environment is different, and so the environment affects in a top-down way the outcomes of evolution. It involves the selection of metabolic networks, gene regulatory networks, proteins, and signal transduction networks. There's a wonderful book on this, Arrival of the Fittest, by Andreas Wagner. At the higher level, there's a section of selection of physiological systems, individuals, and social groups. In all cases, selection of the outcome is environmentally dependent and involves an arrow of time, birth, growth, development, and survival or death. And the processes of biological emergence crucially involves epigenetic effects. The organism and the organs act down to the level of cells to affect what's happening through cell signaling. The organs and the tissues act down to the level of proteins and genes through gene regulatory networks. And the protein machinery selects, reads, and corrects genes again through gene regulatory networks. And so, although the emergence of complexity crucially involves top-down as well as bottom-up processes, the emergent era of time is determined in a bottom-up way, because while those processes are taking place, it is being implemented by the underlying physics. And the arrow of time has occurred down right at the bottom level at the underlying physics here, and the arrow of time cascades up to the emergent organisms from the bottom levels, where it has been established by the processes I've already discussed. And then So the emergent area of time is determined in a bottom-up way from the underlying microphysics. The thermodynamic and electromagnetic areas determine the other local areas in a bottom-up way through process of emergence, biochemistry, molecular biology, cell biology, and the brain through action potentials. These then give the evolutionary and psychological era of times. And there's a note here. The psychological era of time points in the direction of expansion of the universe, which is why we see the universe to be expanding. If the arrow pointed the other way, we would see the universe to be collapsing. And closing notes, how does this relate to the ADM formalism and Lorentz invariance? The ADM formalism can easily be used for this process along Ricci eigenlines and with proper time parameters, and it's described in that paper there. The real universe is not Lorentz invariant. The local group is moving at a certain speed relative to the cosmological reference frame. We don't live in a de Sitter universe. There is a preferred reference frame, and there's the evidence, the cosmic dipole, caused by my motion relative to the universe. So don't tell me that there aren't any preferred spatial sections in the universe. There are, because the universe is not Lorentz invariant. We need to add consideration to the gravitational era of time and CPT issues. How does this relate to quantum theory and quantum gravity? My opinion on this, and I know people here don't agree, but my opinion is that the present is where collapse of the wave function takes place, the uncertain future changing to the fixed past. And that's my view of what, at the micro level, is the present. It's where the collapse is taking place, and the classical is emerging from the quantum. Quantum gravity relation, spin frome broadly has the kind of emergent structure envisaged here, and we're going to hear about that later. That needs development, but I think there's a lot of interesting work to be done developing these two things. Overall conclusion, the temporal passage is a fundamental feature of reality because it's built into the evolving block universe. It's not illusory. It is well described by an evolving block universe with a future boundary that changes with time. And one final question. In the last session, the question is, what is emergent kind of issues? Why is biology different from physics? And this is a very interesting article in Nature by Hartwell, Hopfield, Siebel, and Murray. Hartwell is a Nobel Prize winner. They're talking about the relation of molecular and cell biology to physics. We argue here for the recognition of functional modules as a critical level of biological organization. Modules are composed of many types of molecule. They have discrete functions derived from interactions among their components. But these functions cannot easily be predicted by studying the properties of isolated components. We believe that general design principles, profoundly shaped by the constraints of evolution, govern the structure and function of the modules. Finally, the notion of function and functional property separates biology from other natural sciences and links it to synthetic disciplines such as computer science and engineering. And that is my answer to the question about real emergence. That's real emergence.
Okay.
Thanks, George. So there's something I would like to understand about downward causation, and I'm not sure I do. So you use the example of epigenetics, for example. Yeah. So a cheerful reductionist might say that if I have a cell with DNA inside it, in principle, I could imagine giving the knowing or giving or imagining I knew the exact quantum state of all of the particles in a 1 micron ball centered on that cell. And I could use the Hamiltonian of the standard model of particle physics to evolve it forward in time a little bit.
You could predict.
Sorry?
Then you would be able to predict.
Right. So do you think that either I can't do that or I would get the wrong answer if I tried?
I think you might very well be able to do that. But the question is, why are those molecules and cells and all the rest there in the first place? And the answer, they can only get there in the first place through the adaptive selection, which led to the existence of those molecules and the cells with the structures that they have. So yes, once they are there, you can predict them part of what, but you can't get there without top-down effects.
But is that a matter of what is the best explanation or what is the best underlying dynamics?
It's the underlying dynamics. It's what Hartwell and Alice are saying. Biology has principles of dynamics. The principle of natural selection is not a principle of physics. It's a principle of biology. It's a biological principle which your namesake has written about in a beautiful fashion. And it doesn't emerge out of physics because it involves function, life and death, survival and so on, which simply are not subjects which occur in any physics textbook. You can't find me any physics textbook which refers to any of those things. So there are biological levels of organization with biological principles. Natural selection is the obvious one. It's not a physics principle, but it does determine what happened.
But if I knew in that little region, you think I could use the laws of physics, the standard model, to successfully predict what would happen next?
I think you can predict upwards, but I don't think you can predict downwards. But there's various reasons. One of the things is that if we just take the human brain, aspects of the human brain are shaped by social interactions, and our brain is adapted to be a social brain. And the social is not a material entity. It's the way we interact with other people, and that is...
I'm just trying to pin you down to this one micron around the cell. Do you want to make a stance on whether or not I could predict what would happen in that little ball?
No, I'm prepared to believe, I'll repeat, I'm prepared to believe that you could predict upwards, but that you can't get to that state without the top-down effect.
You even can't predict upwards because that little micron ball is interacting with the
environment.
That's the whole idea of that.
Yeah, well, actually, there's another point which actually I must bring in here. It's a fundamental principle of microbiology and the brain that random processes are really important. Molecular machinery uses random processes. Synapses, there's a lot of randomness about it, and there's quite a lot of evidence now that the brain and molecular machines use randomness as a resource. Now, in effect, from my viewpoint, the way they do that is randomness provides a whole ensemble of possibilities, and then the top-down selection chooses from those possibilities the one which is going to be the one which is going to be adapted. And so randomness is actually, if you look at some of the literature now, an important resource which is used by molecular machines in order to do what they want to do. And so in that sense, I don't think you could predict the specific outcome because there's a terrific amount of randomness, but you could predict the broad things which would happen. There's two kinds. There's just between levels, there's a huge amount of randomness. For instance, at synapses, the diffusion of molecules across the synapse, there's a lot of randomness. But at the bottom level, there's quantum uncertainty. Now, I know you don't believe in it, but I do believe in it.
let's go to Chris next.
Yeah, so I can see there's the contrast between the global character of the cosmological definition of time, right, and sort of local thermodynamic time, and that gives you a reason for saying it's top down from sort of global to local. Yeah. But there's also a challenge that poses, which is, you know, you're invoking something about the cosmological arrow in order to explain why it is that everybody's coffee is cooling down in the same direction, right?
Right.
So could you fill that in a bit?
Well, it's a combination of the fact that the universe is expanding plus the initial condition. The fact that the universe is expanding is crucial to the way that stuff like nucleosynthesis takes place, as I've kind of emphasized. And if as I say, Martin Rees did this in the 1970s, if you run the equation backwards, because they're irreversible processes, you don't get a rerun of the thing backwards. You get a completely different types of stuff happening. But then, as David Albert was saying, through the initial condition, the statistic physics chooses from the two possible ways entropy will be, it chooses the forward way, and so that's the way it goes. And so there are two aspects to this. There is the evolving block universe, but then there's the initial condition at the start.
Things. I was struck by your idea that basically the past hypothesis becomes your top-down. That's a global imposition or global boundary condition, which then determines or is the top-down causation. So, if you could unpack that a little bit more, and specifically in also with Lee's idea, Lee and Roberto's, that time is real. That this is what then imposes history, which is a one-time history.
So my conclusion is yes, time is real. The block universe is moving on in time, and as I said, I have to tell a story about this because I can't resist this. There's a fossil museum in the Karoo in South Africa where you've got all these fossils, and there's a guy who teaches you all about them. The visitor came in and looked around, and he said, "That fossil looks fantastic. How old is it?" And the guy said, "It's 2,023 years old." He said, "How do you know that?" He said, "Well, 23 years ago when I came here, it was 2 million years."
Hello. Yeah, so I'm wondering whenever these top-down, bottom-up things are discussed, there's a lot of disagreement, and some of it seems to be about the role of determinism. So I want to rephrase Sean's question a bit. Suppose I chose the origin to be the Midlands of Great Britain, and I chose a sphere or an area of, let's say, I don't know, a couple of hundred kilometers, and I knew the wave functions of all the particles there. Would you be prepared to believe that I could have predicted the Brexit vote would be 52% leave, 48% remain?
No, because I believe in quantum uncertainty. I believe that quantum theory gives you the statistics of happen. I don't believe it gives you specific outcomes. And so I don't think that the wave function will tell you anything about the specific outcomes.
So I would interpret that to mean that at some point there are limits to determinism.
Yeah.
Okay,
absolutely.
Because I think the thrust of his question was that if you knew it, there really are not. I'm quantum determinism, too.
To me... That's
what I'm referring to.
I'm not a quantum physicist. I'm very aware of that. But nevertheless, that picture that was taken in Japan of the interference pattern building up with the individual photons building up, the statistics is described by quantum physics. Which individual one is going to come there is not described by quantum physics. And so quantum physics does not describe in a deterministic way what is going to happen in the universe. It's not a question of not knowing. It's a question that in principle it does not determine.
But when it comes to other levels, one has similar questions. One is interested in to what extent, let's say, human behavior can and cannot be predicted.
Yeah.
And I think the general view of reductionism is if you just give me enough computer muscle power and the right data, I actually could predict the Brexit vote.
No.
But that's a... Well, that's at least my understanding
no,
of
Rob,
our
core. Rob
okay,
and Sean,
let me
remind you of a crucial thing, which is that the Schrödinger equation and the wave function is only part of quantum mechanics.
Yeah, exactly.
In order to compute and predict something that's measurable, you have to know what the observables are, and you have to know how to represent them as quantum operators. And to come to Sean's example, if I ask a biologically relevant question, like the concentration of a certain protein in your 1 micron sphere, to define that observable, I have to know a lot of chemistry and a lot of biology. To know its significance and to want to ask it, I have to know a lot of biology. And to actually figure out what its value is, I have to use top-down reasoning, not bottom-up reasoning, because if, for example, in that micron sphere, there's a species that's gone extinct, and here I'm paraphrasing an argument I'm borrowing from my friend across the way there, then the concentration will be zero because the species went extinct for reasons of fitness that can only be explained and discussed in a top-down way. So reductionism fails. It's true that the wave function, or one can assert that the wave function of the universe evolves deterministically, but to draw conclusions of it relevant for concentrations of molecules, you have to use dynamics that goes above the level of molecules at the level of species and organisms.
Yeah.
And this is where naive determinism fails and has to give way to top-down.
I want to just make one comment about the microbiology stuff. From the propaganda out there, one sort of tends to focus on DNA and RNA as the magic in life, but in fact the magic in life is proteins. Proteins are where the real action is, and they're amazing. And if you want to have some fun, go home to Google and look up kinesin, and you'll see this molecule walking along, carrying a load from one part of the cell to another part of the cell. There is no way that that could have come about by random assemblage. It has been designed to carry a load from there to there. I'm using the design not in an intelligent design way, but in a Darwinian way. It's been designed to carry a load from one part of the cell to another, and there is absolutely no way it will come together by random assemblage.
Sure. So, but I mean, I was being, about the quantum thing, I was being a bit extreme in the Schrödinger, just to emphasize the point. But my real question is there determinism from one level to the next? So start at whatever level you want
yep.
to predict the Brexit vote, maybe with human beings. If I had the proper theory of humans, is there enough in that theory with those organizational principles to fully deterministically predict what happens at the next level
well,
up? Well, I don't care if it's quantum or not. To me, that's a secondary issue.
Yeah. We're guessing at this point. My guess would be no, and I don't think it's just a question of not sufficient computing power. There are higher level principles at work, like what happened in the Brexit thing was, it was because of people's thoughts, people's perceptions, and a whole lot of stuff like that. Thoughts and perceptions have causal power. They change what happens on the earth. One of the things we do not know, we don't understand the hard problem of consciousness. Until we understand the hard problem of consciousness, we're all guessing.
So I'm a bit perplexed about your comments about Lorentz invariants and the Bloch universe in the following sense that, I mean, it's undoubtable that there is a special frame, the cosmic frame is special, right? But at the same time, this is related to isotropy and homogeneity in the late universe, right? So you seem to be extrapolating that this frame existed all the way to the beginning of the universe. And at the same time, there is another issue that, I mean, we don't have Lorentz invariants, but we have local Lorentz invariants, which means local physics doesn't actually know about this global frame.
We actually don't have local Lorentz invariants. We have broken local Lorentz invariants. Let me make a statement. There's a large part of general relativity which deals with vacuum solutions of the Einstein field equations. My statement is nowhere in the real universe is there a vacuum. Okay.
Our experiments see what I would call local Lorentz symmetry, which means essentially matter doesn't really know of the existence of any preferred frame.
The equations are Lorentz symmetry, the solutions are not. You do that experiment in a specific Lorentz frame, the experiments are not Lorentz invariant, they are in a specific frame. The underlying equations are Lorentz invariant, the experiments are not.
Still, I mean, it's an arbitrary theory with some global foliation. Right. In an arbitrary theory with some global foliation, I would actually be able to detect that foliation even locally. It's not that trivial to claim that there is a global foliation somewhere, and I'm just not seeing it locally.
We have a whole section on Thursday devoted to this question.
But let me step back one step. I am proposing one particular way of determining a unique foliation since the beginning of the universe using proper time integral long Ricci eigenlines. Nobody has thought to ask me about what happens to the surfaces of simultaneity as a result. And I will just tell you now, the surfaces of constant time are generically not surfaces of simultaneity. And in fact, if you start stepping back and asking yourself, what is the physical meaning of simultaneity? The answer is simultaneity has no physical meaning. Simultaneity is a purely psychological construct. Let me talk about that. If you send a rover to Mars and it's going around on the surface of Mars, now you send it a signal. So now I'm sending a signal. It takes 4 minutes to get there and then 4 minutes to get back. So 4 minutes after you've sent it off, there's a time and you say, it's received it now. And then 4 minutes later, it comes back here. That time has got only psychological. It makes no difference to the physics. What matters when you sent the signal, it matters when it's received, it matters when it comes back, but what you call simultaneous makes no difference to any physics.
Okay, so Roberto?
Yeah. So these three presentations that we have heard this afternoon suggest the elements of an intellectual program. And in the spirit of responding to the general theme of our meeting, I want to say something about that program. To misrepresent this program as a reenactment of the traditional disputes about reductionism would be to squander an intellectual opportunity. The most striking statement in Neil's intervention was his observation that we cannot derive a view of time from a study of local phenomena, from one of the disciplines of physics that studies closed subsystems of the world. He seems to have been misled by his distaste for Barbara's somewhat Hegelian vocabulary into not registering the affinity of his view with hers. In Barbara's presentation, the central element was the view of a discipline with three attributes, that it addresses causation top down and not simply a bottom up, that it takes time seriously, and that it has the universe as a whole for its subject. The only discipline that is capable of satisfying these three criteria would be a cosmology practiced as a historical science. And that's what I understand to have been the message of her presentation. Now, George has added a third element to this intellectual program. And the third element is the idea that cosmology should not be understood as a sideshow or an afterthought in fundamental science, but rather as the master science. We are accustomed to address the cosmic from the standpoint of the local. Now the task is to turn the tables. And a cosmology then becomes the perspective from which all study of local phenomena must be addressed. That's the point that reveals the deep unity between what Neil claimed and what Barbara proposed.
Okay.
Now, nothing contributes more to the definition of an intellectual program than to understand what its enemies are. And it has three enemies. The first enemy is the impulse to avoid or mitigate trouble. And there seem to be two main devices to avoid trouble now. One of them is to assign more and more inconvenient facts to the arbitrarily stipulated initial conditions of the universe. And the other device is to attempt to convert an explanatory embarrassment into an explanatory triumph by postulating the existence of multiple universes with which we cannot have, even in principle, a causal communion. The second enemy of this view is then the traditional attempt to develop a cosmology out of the specialized disciplines of physics, rather than the other way around. And the third enemy is the effort to canonize the marriage in general relativity between its empirical residue and its metaphysical conception, such as the spatialization of time. Time to sue for divorce.
I just want to add something. You're talking about cosmology as a fundamental science. The traditional top-down effects in cosmology, which go back particularly Hermann Bondi's book in 1960 and Dennis Sharma's book in 1962, was Mach's principle, Olbers' paradox, and the arrow of time. Those are the three which are the traditional ones.
So just in the interest of time, which we're discussing here a lot, we should actually move to our next speaker. So let's thank the speaker again. Okay, so we have Stuart Kaufman on downward causation beyond reductionism.
I'm the lone biologist, a stranger in a strange land. I hope that some of what I have to say is useful. Can you hear me?
No.
Is this on? It just went on. Magic. Is it on? Okay. I'm a stranger in a strange land. Okay, so listen, just read the top title. Skip the subtitle. I'm going to just give the middle of my talk. I'm a biologist, and what I have to say in the middle is probably most important for this session. So I want to look at downward causation. I think it takes us beyond reductionism, and I want to try to be careful about it, and I have to put in some stuff that's not on the slides. It's not going forward. Oh, I have the wrong clicker. Okay, thanks. Okay, so skip number one. I want to talk about the non-isotropic character of the universe, not with respect to what you think, but with respect to the following. You all know that proteins are made of 20 kinds of amino acids. A typical protein in you is about 300 amino acids long. Some are 2,000 amino acids long. How many possible proteins are there, length 200? Well, 20 types of amino acids raised to the 200th power. That's 10 to the 260th. Let's ask whether or not the universe can have made all possible proteins in the known lifetime of the universe at the Planck time scale with all 10 to the 80th or so particles simultaneously making proteins length 200 every Planck moment. And the answer is it would take something like 10 to the 39th times the history of the universe to make all those possible proteins once. The universe is grotesquely non-repeating at levels of complexity above atoms. So I'm going to go up the scale in complexity, not in the sense of galaxies, but in the sense of complex, for example, molecules. So this means, and in fact, life on Earth has probably explored something like, at most, 10 to the 40th or 10 to the 50th of 10 to the 260th. That means something terribly important, and I think it's physical. History enters when the space of the possible is vastly larger than what can actually happen. Okay, so that's the non-isotropic character of the universe. But it's also true not only for chemistry, it's clearly true for the biosphere. And what this means is the following really important things. Most complex things, not in the sense of planets, but even planets, but most complex things in the sense of, for example, hearts, will never come to exist. Which raises the question, why do hearts exist in the universe? Everybody in this room has one. And if you don't, please stand up and run out. Okay? This is a little tough. Okay? Well, this turns out to be a really deep question, I think, because, and I'm going to go a little more slowly here than I would have otherwise. Let's ask what the function of the heart is, and it's going to be central to accept functional language. I will try to take a moment to defend functional language. We all know what the function of the heart is. It's to pump blood. Harvey worked that out, right? Darwin says the function of the heart is to pump blood, but look, your heart makes heart sounds and it jiggles water in your pericardial sac. I'm a doctor, I know, okay? Of course, I'm not the Bohr lecturer, but okay. But really, your heart makes heart sounds, but that's not the function of the heart. That means something important. If you accept functional language, the function of the heart is a subset of its causal consequences, right? In physics, you cannot distinguish among the causal consequences of a part. It makes no sense whatsoever. If you accept functional language in biology, you cannot reduce biology to physics. I'll come back to that, because George already has talked about it. But we're going to come back to it. Okay, now, why is the selective value of your heart pumping blood important? It's because your heart keeps you alive. And keeping you alive allows you to be a complex thing that exists in the universe. One way to be a complex thing in the universe is to be a reproducing thing. It's called an autopoietic whole, or an autocatalytic set, I worked on the origin of life for years. Okay, and you get to exist in the universe for a long time. It's called a Kantian whole. The parts exist for and by means of the whole. What's central about organisms is the parts exist for and by means of the whole. Okay, so you can't get to it from physics, and you won't. Okay. Now, I want to talk now about natural selection. If you look at the origin of species, Darwin changed our thinking more than anybody since Newton. There's not a single equation in the origin of species. Why not? Because they're irrelevant. Why are they irrelevant? Well, think about it for a moment. We all understand natural selection, heritable variation, variation, heritable variation, and natural selection. It doesn't matter to Darwin what the means are by which reproduction happens at all. Could have been anything. It turns out to be us and DNA and RNA and proteins. Darwin didn't know that. Natural selection is occurring on a level that's independent of the specific physical stuff of which it's made. The constants of nature could be different. If we still had reproducing things, we'd still get Darwinian selection. This is precisely Barber's point. The platform on which evolution runs is independent of the specific physical basis of it. You will not reduce Darwin to specific physics. You just won't, period. Okay? Now, so let's talk about this with respect to downward causation. Natural selection is a prime example of downward, in some sense, causation. I'm going to be careful about saying causation. What winds up living is what winds up living. So let's talk about an E. coli, a bacterium in your gut, with a mutant in it, in some environment. What gets selected, and I want to just try to say this very clearly, is the organism in its world. It's not the mutation that gets selected, it's the organism living in its world that gets selected. It's not the DNA mutation that gets selected, it's the whole organism, a Kantian whole, in its world that gets selected. Okay? So, therefore, what does it mean to be fitter? What does it mean for E. coli to be fitter? Well, it means for E. coli to be fitter that it gets to exist in the biosphere for a while. Actually, E. coli has been around for quite a while. So is T. rex. T. rex is gone. 99% of all species have come and gone. But they're really complex things that got to exist in the universe. And the question is whether or not you can explain the specificity of Neil's brain from understanding quantum mechanics and upward. And the answer is, I'm going to make a distinction between Andy as an organism right now and trying to explain how your heart works, which I think we can do from physics. I don't think we can explain the diachronic becoming of you since the origin of life. I think that's beyond the reach of underlying physics. So I want to distinguish between an historical becoming, which goes back to the non-isotropic nature of the universe above the level of atoms. Biology is an historical science.
So you're not talking about a lack of computing power.
No. I am absolutely talking about something else, okay? So another thing that we know, I'm going to talk about the biosphere and the economy. They both exploded in diversity. In the first case, the biosphere, in the last 3.5 billion years, there was maybe one or a few things around. There's maybe 100 to 200 million species around now. The diversity of the biosphere has exploded. Why? Why has that happened? Why is the species diversity of the biosphere enormous? What about the global economy? 50,000 years ago, there was maybe 1,000 things in the global economy. What's the diversity of things in the global economy now? It's in the billions. Why? Why did that happen? The next thing to notice is that in the non-ergodic universe, the more you go up in complexity, the ever more sparsely you'll sample that space. Okay? Now, I want to say something else and come back to it. In statistical physics, you know the phase space. You have the gas molecules in the Lieder box, and you can state the phase space. It's a 6n-dimensional phase space. Watch as we go forward. You cannot state the phase space of the biosphere. And I'm going to show you as we come a little further. It changes in ways that you cannot pre-state. If you can't, what do we mean by entropy? What's the entropy of the biosphere? Okay, and part of the problem is functional variables, and I'll get to that in a moment. Okay, now, I wish I had more time to tell you about this, but I want to talk briefly about the adjacent possible. It's what can happen next. It's what can come to exist next. For example, 150 years ago, computers didn't exist. Now we have the internet. The internet couldn't exist until computers were invented, and there was no point whatsoever in inventing a channel changer until there were television sets, right? T-Rex couldn't come into existence until there were multicelled organisms. T-Rex came, T-Rex is gone, we're here now. The astonishing thing is we create evolution and the evolving biosphere create the very opportunities, the very possibilities into which they become. Okay, so just to show you in the economy, you couldn't have the web before you had computers. Given file sharing due to Microsoft, once there's file sharing, it becomes a bright idea to invent the web, right? So File sharing has in its adjacent possible its use in creating a web, but you couldn't have it beforehand. This is going up in complexity, and if I had more time, I would show you that with what are called Darwinian pre-adaptations, organisms literally create in evolution the niches into which they become. I'll call them enabling constraints. We don't have the notion of enablement in physics, but it's sure there in biology, and it's certainly there in the economy. And in biology, we don't yet have to worry about consciousness, although I'm perfectly prepared to. Okay, so I really want to focus on 7, and how much more time do I have? Okay, good, because I want really to focus on 7 and skip maybe just a tiny bit on 8. Okay, I want now to try to convince you in 5 minutes there is no Newton-like law whatsoever for the evolution of the biosphere. I think you can perfectly well explain Andy's heart, but you can't explain the evolution of giraffes. So I'm going to start with it's going to sound a very strange thing, but I'm going to ask all of you. Please tell me, here's a screwdriver. I'm not handing you a screwdriver. Please tell me all the uses of a screwdriver. Do you feel your mind going a little blank? Well, just let's name some uses of a screwdriver.
The uses of a screwdriver?
Yeah, here, I'm going to hand you one, Carlo. What?
Do a demonstration of lecture.
What?
Do a demonstration.
Yes! Okay, so look, we can screw in a screw. Right, I can open a can of paint. I can stab you, right? I can flip it in the ground and stick it. I can tie it to a stick and spear a fish. I can rent the spear to the locals and catch, as they catch the fish, I take 5%, right? I can scrape putty off the window. Do you want to give some more? Yes, you can drive, find the height of a building by dropping it off, and we all know the joke. Okay? So, but only physicists know it, except for occasional biologists. So, I'm now going to seduce you. Will you accept the notion that the uses of a screwdriver here in Waterloo, the number of uses of a screwdriver is indefinite? It's not infinite, it's indefinite. If I suck you into this, you're lost. Is it indefinite, or do you know the number of uses of a screwdriver? Can you say the number of uses of a screwdriver, yes or no? Huh? Yes, it's definitely N, but N is indefinite. Next, you all know that there are nominal scales, greater than scales, partial orderings, interval scales, and ratio scales. The uses of a screwdriver are just a bunch of different uses. They're just different uses. There's no ordering among them, right?
Sorry, but if you give me finite time and finite room, I think you can label all the uses. Just by labeling all this position in that quantum state.
You won't get a use out of it.
I have the n plus one use, which is to refute you.
Yes, okay. Yes, right, because I can throw it at you and kill you before you do it. Let's come back to it, okay. So let me just sort of go ahead for a second. I claim that because of this, there's no effective algorithm whatsoever. There's no computer out. There's no Turing machine that can compute all the uses of a screwdriver or compute the next use of a screwdriver. That is to say, the uses of a screwdriver is not algorithmic. It's not law governed. There's no law in the sense of algorithmic law governed whatsoever to define the uses of a screwdriver. Okay, now, what has to happen in evolution? And here's the critical step. All that has to happen in evolution is that some molecular screwdriver in a bacterium find a use, I'm being very careful in my words, find a use that enhances the fitness of the bacterium, and if there's heritable variation for it, and it enhances the fitness of the organism, it'll be selected. But you couldn't say ahead of time what that use was. It was unexpected causal consequences of the screwdriver that came to be useful in that environment, and that's what Darwin calls a Darwinian pre-adaptation. It doesn't mean foresight, it just means it turns out to be useful. But you couldn't say it.
The internet is an example.
The internet's an example, and I'll give you one other. Some fish have an organ called a swim bladder. It's a sac filled with air and water that gives neutral buoyancy in the water column. I can say this fast because I've said it lots of times. Paleontologists believe that swim bladders evolved from fish with lungs called lungfish, and water got into some lungs, and they evolved into a swim bladder. So let's say the paleontologists are right. Could you have said it 3 billion years ago? You didn't even know there'd be multicelled organisms, right? Furthermore, that isn't the use of a screwdriver, okay? It's the use of a sack that had air in it, now to be filled with air and water, that conferred neutral buoyancy on the water column. Let's ask, did a new function come to exist in the biosphere? Yes, neutral buoyancy came to exist in the biosphere. It really did. There's a whole bunch of fish that have swim bladders. Now let's ask whether or not that changed the evolution of the biosphere. Watch. Once there is a fish with a swim bladder, can a worm or a bacterium evolve to live only in swim bladders? Of course, right? There's a worm that lives only, there's a bacterium that lives only in the lungs of sheep. It's mycoplasma. It's the simplest one that we know. But there are worms that live only in eyeballs. That means that the swim bladder, once it exists, is what I will call an adjacent possible empty niche. It's an opportunity for evolution. The worm or the bacterium really could come to live in it, right? Now, I'm going to ask another funny question. Do we think that to personalize natural selection, that natural selection struggled to make a functioning swim bladder? Well, yeah, it didn't struggle, but it did. Do we think that natural selection acted in any way to make the swim bladder as an adjacent possible empty niche? No. That means that the biosphere is creating its own possibilities for becoming without even selection achieving it. And it's the same thing, as you just said, George, for Microsoft and word processing to have created an adjacent possible in which there was the web. And once there was a web, could you sell things on the web? Yeah. Could Amazon come into existence? Yes. Okay? And Facebook have come into existence. Could they 1,000 years ago? No. So there's an adjacent possible and we become into it. So all of this leads to the following, and then I'm going to stop. In Newton, we know what the initial conditions, the boundary conditions, and the phase space are. We define it with our initial and boundary conditions, which, Lee, I know you're struggling against. What are the initial and boundary conditions for the biosphere? There aren't any that we can state. But furthermore, we cannot write down differential equations. We do not know the relevant variables. 3 billion years ago, we did not know swim bladders. The phase space of biological evolution includes functionality, includes the function of the heart as pumping blood. That's why they exist in the universe above the level of atoms. But we can't write down what those variables are. The very phase space of biological evolution changes as evolution goes along. Therefore, we cannot write down differential equations for the becoming of the biosphere diachronically. Therefore, we can't integrate that equation. Therefore, there are no equations whatsoever that entail the becoming of the biosphere. But the biosphere is part of the universe, and bless you all, I adore what I'm learning here, and so far as I can learn it, you will not deduce the becoming of the biosphere from particle physics. Thank you. Andy.
Nope.
Well, I guess somebody else will just go.
So, I mean, as a complacent reductionist, I think your narrative is fine. I don't have any objection to it, but I feel that it's just lack of computing power that stops me. I mean, your swim bladder is made out of quarks and gluons and electrons.
Of course it is.
And yeah, but then that's a
Andy, you go ahead. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So,
go ahead, finish.
So then my question is, what are you trying to change how I do science?
No. Okay. I would like you to use your computing power to look at the screwdriver that you're using to screw in a screw and compute that you could use it as a sphere-to-sphere
fish.
So
the fact is, what I do, I never do anything from first principles, but it's a guiding framework.
And the answer
in
my
terms
question.
Of how I think about science.
Hang on, answer my question. You just said you could use computing power to compute from the fact that there is a sac called a lung of a lungfish, that it could become a swim bladder, or that you could use a screwdriver.
It's part of the phase space.
Hmm?
It's totally part of the phase space.
Name the phase space, Andy.
It's
what are
the electrons and quarks
You've bought the use of the word function, I'll defend the word function if you want in a second, but once you bought the word function is not a discriminable, pre-statable causal consequence of anything.
But you can notice it. You can look at parts of phase space and notice it there. You can see parts of phase space that have functions that haven't been realized in nature and ones that have. I mean, it's all there. By the way, I want to acknowledge Faye. We're talking about her space.
Andy, look, here's another way of saying it. is there any pre-statable set of functionalities of things? No.
I totally agree with that.
Okay. Then if there's not a pre-statable space of
functionality. That's a limit of my ability to state things, not, I mean.
No. Look,
the phase space is there waiting for all of this to happen or not happen. That's my
phase space is a configuration space set
but you can't state what the phase space is. And not only can you not state what the phase space is, the very come into existence of the in the universe of hearts depends upon that fact that they pump blood, and that turned out to be useful for a bunch of species that were too big.
So phase space is really big and really complicated. And
yeah, but the problem with the phase space, in your sense, is so much bigger than the number of possible things that exist in the universe.
Jim, it's not even that. It's that functionalities are something special.
It's a way of understanding what's actually happening.
Yeah, because it's functionalities
that
matter.
So as a practical thing, I totally agree with that.
No, it's not
as a practical thing. And I'm just asking about the conceptual thing.
It's not practical.
We're limited.
Oh, good. That's not practical.
No, we're limited by the number of particles that you have in the Hubble horizon and by the Hubble time.
That's right. You're saying I can't make a computer.
Yeah,
I know.
Bigger, the computing power will be longer than the Hubble time.
Yeah, I know. I agree. But that's practical. That's practical to me. Yeah.
It's not practical.
It's just a concept. But to me, it's a semantic argument.
Okay. So think about this. Where is nature making all these complicated computations with this huge configuration space? Where are the currents?
Nature is a quantum computer. Yeah. Nature is a quantum computer.
To have a configuration space so big.
This is not sounding like intelligent design. How could it be? It is.
So here are two further opinions on that, I think.
I think you said something very important. You said it's not practical, but it's possible in principle. To me, science should be about what is in fact practical. What relates to the real world, not some in principle it might happen, but what is actually real in the real universe?
Just a second. Can I say something here? Let me defend for a moment the use of the word function in biology. The universe is non-ergodic above the level of atoms. I think we agree. Okay, that's not contentious. A Kantian whole, Kant said, an organized being then, in an organized being, the parts exist for and by means of the whole. Let me give you an example. I've worked on the origin of life for a year. Darwin doesn't explain the origin of life. He starts with it. Consider a set of molecules that react, and they can mutually catalyze one another's formation. Call it a collectively autocatalytic set. Gonen Ashkenazi has a 9-peptide collectively autocatalytic set in Ben-Gurion. Given that set, it is reproducing. I mean, Gonen takes it out and it reproduces. It gets to exist in the non-ergodic universe above the level of atoms because it reproduces, yes? It's a Kantian whole. No part catalyzes its own formation. The set as a whole catalyzes its formation. Given that, I claim, I'm going to define function as follows. It gets to exist in the non-ergodic universe above the level of atoms, and the function of one peptide is to catalyze the formation of the next, not jiggle water in the Petri plate. Now, what's the function of something in a cell? It contributes to the reproduction of the cell. If you look at a part in a cell, how do you discriminate its function? What's the function of the heart? Is it to jiggle water in the pericardial sac? Is it to make heart sounds? Or is it to pump blood? It's a subset of its causal consequences. Can you say, just looking at the whole thing as a physical system, what its function is? No, you must look at it as an organized thing that's reproducing as in the non-ergodic universe above the level of atoms. That's how you have to describe it. That's why Darwin's theory is not reducible to physics. It's independent of the underlying physics. It really is.
I'm fine with that. I don't have any problem
with
the words.
So we have Lee and then there.
The argument that I made before applies here as well. If you think you understand the phase space of the biosphere and you want to ask by such and such a year how many screwdrivers will there be, there's no function on the phase space which is pre-statable or pre-computable to tell you what subspace or what subset of the phase space counts as there exists so many screwdrivers. You don't know in 20 years or 500 years what will be a screwdriver. You don't know all the different ways that a screwdriver might be constructed or constituted. because they depend on a myriad of other decisions. So what, so...
They come to exist, Andy, just like Neil's brain.
I use them.
What?
I use them. I don't need a function over face.
No, so the...
You need to account the coming into existence of Neil's brain. Why did Neil's brain come into existence in the universe? Why did hearts come to exist?
So his heart reproduced.
What? Yes, that too. No, that's getting personal. So Neil's brain really came to existence, so did yours, and so did your eyes. Yeah, by the way, there's a bacterium that has eyes.
So that's a nice narrative to give to all these
people. Andy, the point is that it's not enough to have Liouville's equations and compute the evolution of the density function on phase space. It's like it's not enough to compute the evolution of the wave function. Phase space is really big, and Hilbert space is exponentially, if that means anything, because it's infinite dimensional, bigger. And the problem is picking out the observables. You can't do classical or quantum mechanics without knowing ahead of time what the observables that you're interested in.
The same thing come like that, it's the same kind of color. Nature picks the observables. Nature evolves us, and we have certain things we can observe, certain things we can't, certain apparatus we can build, certain things we can. So nature is picking observables as well.
So the claim is that some of the observables are labeled and defined by functions, and you have to get into a functional language in order to compute meaningful observables, and therefore you're trapped with downward causation because you have to discuss functionality.
Which is why they come to exist.
What the observables are.
Okay, that's why they come. That's literally why they come to exist. That's why there are hearts.
That sounds practical to me. Like, my schlucky little brain isn't, and all the computers in the world can't model all of this. So, big deal.
Should we go to some other people?
Yes. So let's give the next one.
Andy, thank you.
Okay. So I want to continue on this simple example of the usage of a screwdriver. Sorry, I'm here. Oh. So I think my statement was that, given that I give you a finite box, I give you a finite time, and your screwdriver, a specific one screwdriver, is put into that finite box, and you can operate that within that finite time.
I can do what?
You can operate that screwdriver any way you want within finite time, but you cannot exceed that box.
I can what?
You cannot move it out of that box, and after that finite time, your chance ends. So within that constraint of finite time and finite space, I can quantify a finite usage. Is that because when you say usage, it seems to secretly contain a lot of degeneracy, right? Even if my screwdriver has moved in these finite spaces in exactly the same trajectory in a finite time, you can imagine, say, I just used that screwdriver to disprove Q. I just used screwdriver to have an example in the Parameter Institute. You can imagine the very different things you do as different usages, or the screwdriver just move exactly in the same functional space and time. And that's a large degeneracy. It's because that degeneracy you think has an infinite number or indefinite number of usages.
I said indefinite. I didn't say indefinite. Listen, here's a way in which I think that you're right. Okay, so let's agree on the following. Suppose that there's a screwdriver floating in space, and a disembodied hand is holding it. Okay, and it's going to be alive for about 4 seconds. Now compare that, is there much that can be done with that screwdriver? Of course, it's a person using it or a person's hand. Okay, not much. What about a screwdriver here in Waterloo, okay, with us wandering around? There's zillions of things you can use it for. Something about the context, which is a phrase that George used and a phrase that Barbara used, bears on the number of uses, the ways that screwdrivers can be used. As the biosphere becomes more diverse, there's more ways that things can interact with one another that are functionally significant, and more ways that they can come to exist with one another, come into existence. The same thing's happened in the evolution of the economy. You couldn't make a living and catch rabbits 50,000 years ago the way we're making a living now, standing in this room babbling at one another. You actually had to catch rabbits. Well, something's happened.
I agree, but let me interject. The question was, you hand me a screwdriver, and what is the usage of that screwdriver? And you just change that into screwdrivers in the world. And you put a different question.
No, I'm saying something that I hadn't said before. You're right, but I said no inappropriately. It's dawned on me from about 5 years ago, and I really started thinking about it in the last year, something very bizarre is happening. The ways that something can find a use, for example, in the biosphere, was very different 3 billion years ago than it is now. The number of ways that you can find to earn a living now is vastly more diverse than it was 50,000 years ago. I mean, there wasn't much you could do 100,000 years ago to earn a living. You went out and caught rabbits. Now you can go be a theoretical physicist and work on quantum gravity and earn a living. Something bizarre is going on, which we are creating around us, the very possibilities by which we make our way in the world. That's true for the biosphere, it's true for the economy. There's something special about life on up that, I mean, I don't think it's there in planets, okay? That has to do with the diversity that creates the opportunities by which we can exist itself explodes to make room for more possibilities of coming into existence. And that's happened. That's the biosphere becoming, and it's the economy becoming.
Sorry, so I think this would be my final comment, is that if you cannot quantify how many, you cannot count how many varieties, there's no way to say that it's low.
Hmm?
If you have no way to quantify how many.
Sure, we can count we can approximate the number of species. There's something like 100 million species now.
I hunt rabbit Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
Not what?
If I hunt rabbit to make a living Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and someone else hunt rabbit for a living on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you can say these two are different. It's about your measure of what count as different.
But look, let's
you,
take...
Before
look,
you
let's
take th- that, let, you cannot claim that it has exploded.
Let's take the biosphere and look at the number of proteins that have been in existence starting with 3.5 billion years ago and now. There's a lot more proteins simultaneously present on the Earth now, we think, than there were when life just started. Probably there wasn't even encoded protein synthesis when life started. There's a lot more species around now than there was, for example, on the order of 700 or 800 million years ago. We know that to be true. And you can define a species by, you know, it's capable of breeding and it's not capable of outbreeding, or you can do it by DNA sequences. There's a lot more DNA sequences around now than there were something like 3 billion years ago. Just sequence them. There's a lot more.
So let us go to the next one now.
Okay. So it strikes me that I hear a lot of very interesting things that you say. Very, very interesting. I listen with enormous attention. And this is true for your talk and other talks. But then they are presented with an emphasis. And they're presented as an emphasis and a sort of conclusion, and therefore this challenge reductionism, which seems to me makes of a straw man of a reductionist, makes him saying things which no reasonable reductionist should say, and I don't follow you anymore there.
Carlo, I'm perfectly happy with that. No reductionist wants to say to explain the evolution of the biosphere, I'm fine.
Obviously, I mean, who would think? Look, you said that there's a huge
Andy.
Number of possible proteins.
Andy's
Wait. you say that there's a huge number of possible proteins. You gave a number, okay? But if you take the atoms of this room, okay, and you count the configuration in which
yes.
they can be, it's much, much, much larger
of course
this
it
number,
is.
Enormously larger. So for a reductionist who sees only the atoms, the
what?
Space for a reductionist
uh-huh.
who has is totally short-sighted to the upper levels, okay, the space of possibility is not smaller than yours, it's much larger than yours. It's totally impossible to explore, it's complicated, so he gives up and says, well, thanks God, there are the biologists to do that, okay? So what you do is you take this immense possibility that for a reduction is huge, and of course, if in principle, if let's put quantum mechanics aside, in principle, if I knew the Newton equation, I could from the, okay, but that's, in principle, it's totally meaningless. I agree with George here. In practice, of course, I cannot compute what's coming
so
after.
Look, yes,
what you do? Wait, what you're doing is take this immense space, reducing it enormously, okay, to the super subset of things which are the proteins, okay. Introduce proper language for that and proper concept for that for
yes.
the protein, which is what science, a good scientist, does. And say, look how large is the space of possibility, and look, I have to work in a different way here. This is very, it's wonderful, but why does it challenge us?
So Carlos, I think I let me repeat what you said and see if I've understood it. If you think of the possible positions and momenta of all the classical particles in the universe at the level of, say, Newtonian-like atoms, it's vastly larger in the universe than anything I'm talking about, and of course that's true. Issue is what gets to come to exist that is more complex than atoms. Now, planets do, and stars do. So do organisms. Organisms have the interesting property that they can reproduce. If they can reproduce, they have the interesting property that they can be selected. If they can be selected, they have the interesting property that we can define the notion of functionality for them, the way I've tried to do. Then what counts for and is relevant to their reproducing is the functionality. And let me define the notion of functional closure. Take my autocatalytic set, okay? It's Gonin Ashkenazi's 9 peptides, mutually catalyzing one another's formation. Define a catalytic task as catalyzing this reaction. That's the function of that peptide. The 9 peptides mutually catalyze one another's formation. That's a catalytic task closure, okay? Rocks don't do that. At least classically, rocks don't do that.
What is the challenge in that?
No. Hang on. There's no challenge to reductionism in taking Gonin's set and saying, how does it work? There's a challenge to explaining the coming into existence over diachronic time in the evolution of the biosphere of what comes to exist like swim bladders. I say with you that, of course, as a reductionist, I can explain the heart once it exists. I can't explain its coming into existence. Okay, that's the claim.
Like Carlo and Andy, I appreciate your comments. I see the reaction of theoretical physicists as the fact that it seems it's always a bad idea to tell theoretical physicists that they can't think about something. Because the history of science is the history of impossible, you know. Of impossible challenges.
But biologists can't think about it either.
So anyway,
yeah.
You know, that's why we're here. If I'm thinking about, you know, the history of physics is full of these impossible challenges. Like, think about yourself in the 1940s, 50s, every day a new particle appearing, complexity growing, yeah. And the type of model that people looked at this model, and it seemed completely hopeless. What happened is the explanation. Explanation is a complete surprise, confinement, mass generation by vacua, which organizes the spectra of globules just from pure number. It's an algebraic, you know, arithmetic series. This, I don't know, you can't foresee a development like that. I'm thinking also artificial intelligence, like, when I studied 30 years ago, there was an impossible problem, which was face recognition. Now, using physics, people can do it. So I just don't know. You know, you might be...
Let me try,
we don't know.
What you guys want is entailing laws. I mean, the Schrodinger equation is an entailing law. It entails the becoming of the unitary of the Schrodinger equation. Newton's laws are entailing. General relativity isn't dynamical, but it's the block universe that you guys know much better than me. What I'm saying is that you cannot write down entailing laws for the becoming of the biosphere, the reasons that I said. That doesn't mean that you cannot explain how an organism works, you know, by standard reductionism. But I can see no way whatsoever for the reasons that I gave to write down entailing laws. Or try writing down entailing laws for the becoming of mathematics.
Maybe, but...
No, just try that.
Maybe.
Try to write down entailing laws for the becoming of mathematics.
Maybe, yeah.
Some differential equation that writes down how mathematics is going to evolve. You have no idea.
You mean predictive?
Why does it have to be differential equation?
Huh?
Why does it have to be differential equation?
Well, that's what you have with Newton, and that's what you have with Schrodinger, right? It's not what you have with Einstein, I know.
But it's not what we eliminated activity.
What? What? Look, my claim's even stronger. Let me give you an example. It's early in life, and life has just evolved, and there's a protocell. And it's floating around in a floating nutrient stream, okay, with a bunch of its brothers and cousins and sisters and so on. And it's got a little protein that is sitting embedded in its membrane. And it's going slowly in a nutrient stream, and the little peptide happens to bind to a tiny rock, and it stops moving. Well, if it's not moving, does it get exposed to more food than if it were floating free in the slowly moving nutrient stream? Sure. Suppose that there's heritable variation for that Darwinian pre-adaptation. It's now become a sessile feeder, right? Sessile feeding just arose in the biosphere. That's how the thing's making a living. It's a sessile feeder. What mathematics will you use to describe the emergence of a sessile feeder?
Okay, so let's, sorry to shut you off, but we have just limited time, so let's have 3 more people to ask a question.
Okay, so I feel like allowing myself a silly comment here.
Everybody knows the Fermi paradox, right? The Fermi paradox says, if it's so likely that alien life is there, how come we don't see the aliens? Now, here's a question for the top-down camp. If causation goes both ways, and I know I can name a bunch of people that were physicists and that did useful things in chemistry and in biology and in sociology and economics. Where are the biologists in physics?
Where what?
Where are the biologists in physics?
What's the point of that question?
It's the Fermi paradox of downwards causation. Where are they?
I don't even know what you're asking me. Are you saying I'm...
It was perhaps...
Right, no, hang on.
It was perhaps too silly.
No, if the point is that I'm too stupid to be a physicist, of course you're right. But let's take this little filter feeder, okay? It just came into existence. How would you even describe it mathematically? You can look at it and say, look at that, it's a filter feeder. It just came into existence in the biosphere, right? Okay, it's like a starfish, you know, sucking on clams. Okay. So I don't even know what you would mathematize to explain the coming into existence of the little filter feeder that's become a sessile feeder. Now, you've asked about the origin of life, and the standard question is, how come life hasn't started all the time? And Darwin gave a reasonable answer. He said, look, if life were to start again, some bacteria would eat it up. Okay, and the analogy is that if I were to try to be a physicist, you'd eat me up too.
Isn't this something that one would have said about the spectrum? Right? Supposing just after Newton, the Newton spectrum, this richness of spectral light. I mean, how many there are? I mean, if you count them all, because there are again going to be many more than. And then I'll say, how could we ever explain this? And then, what mathematics would you use? Are you going to use phase space? What are the phase space you're going to use?
Well, we're not.
The thing is, it's a change, and then we're quantum mechanics. Well, and we can explain spectrum.
So I'm not going to persuade those of you who wish to be scientists to think that what counts as being a scientist is deducing things from something like laws. Do paleontologists do science? Sure they do. They look at the history of life and try to figure out that the swim bladder evolved from lungfish. That's science, but above the level of atoms and the complexity going up to sociology, okay, it's an historical science, cosmology maybe too, I'm not prepared to talk about that, and understanding what derived from what in the biosphere is all of paleontology. They're doing science. Do paleontologists try to predict what species is going to arrive 2 million years from now? Would you?
No, I'm saying that just as even Newton could not imagine quantum mechanics would explain all these things.
Okay.
Right? So today we can already imagine, I'm with you. But to make a statement that therefore it could never be done seems like an extrapolation to me. Just for the same reason.
But I've told you my grounds. Right. We can argue about it. Yeah. Okay.
I want to simultaneously answer Rob, but he's gone, and Andy, in the following way. He asked about Brexit. Could you predict Brexit? So I will extend that. If we knew everything about the atoms on the last scattering surface, the particles in every possible detail, could we predict Brexit, right? So I think you're saying we could, if we had sufficient...
We'd have an ensemble.
Sorry?
We'd have a quantum ensemble.
Well, if you have an ensemble, then in some of them you get Brexit and some of them you aren't, so you can't predict Brexit.
That's the real deal.
So the real deal is you cannot predict what is happening in this room at this moment from what's...
That's the fundamental uncertainty. That's uncertain.
Well, okay,
That's truly unpredictable.
But in fact, if you actually take it seriously, you can't even predict that this this galaxy will exist.
In the quantum sense, absolutely, yes. You predict the wave function, and it has... some galaxies existing and some not.
Okay, in that case, you're not actually saying that we can predict what happens.
I think it's right. It's clearly a radioactive decay, a mutation which kills someone.
You can predict the possibility space without knowing anything whatever about the wave function. The possibility space is there before you've got any wave function.
But we're just arguing about semantics. Just in practice, all I can do is the stuff you describe. I do some toy model, I do some course training, lucky to describe the time.
Yeah, well, so you see, my position is that in order to understand Brexit, what you have to understand is that human minds have the capacity to make logical argumentations, emotional argumentations, social interactions, and it is at that level that Brexit happens. It isn't at the level of particles and wave functions.
Right. And
once life begins, also something lifts you above just
the atoms, just knowing the phase space.
Exactly. And the reason is that you are an autopoietic system, a system that creates itself and reproduces in the non-ergodic universe above the level of atoms. And that gives you selection, which is a kind of top-down causation. It's not really causation. It's just what gets to exist. Yeah, we probably want to quit pretty quick.
No, Barbara's question.
Oh.
Yes, Barbara has one more question, and maybe we should afterwards slowly finish this. Okay.
I would like to comment also on this huge, huge, huge phase space that is just much, much, much larger than anything that is realized in nature. And science is about why the world is the way it is. So science looks for principles. And I think you have wonderfully shown us that many things are contingent and cannot be predicted in advance. But once things are there, then you can have new principles, new laws or rules that act with the entities that you have present in the system then. And concerning evolution, one principle you mentioned is this principle of natural selection, which cannot be reduced to physics. And I would like to add that I like very much the work by Simon Conway Morris on convergent evolution.
Yes.
And he likes to emphasize that in evolution, many things have happened again and again, like the camera eye has evolved independently several times and many other sensing organs. So he says there are deeper principles even in evolution that we don't yet know. And again, those are not reducible to physics, not related to physics, but they are there.
Yeah, I mean, why does the eye work? Well, you know, Darwin was terrified by the eye because it's a camera eye. It turns out there's a dinoflagellate that's just been found that has an eye. It's a single celled organism that has an eye.
No.
Okay.
But look, the eye works. That's why it's there.
Good. So I guess we should thank all the three speakers again for this session. You.